that when I look, we look at see churches that are thriving, we see certain characteristics. One of them is a certain set of frames around theology. And so I want to talk a little bit about theology a little bit, or theological frameworks. There's three B words that sometimes get used, and I'm just going to write them up here on the board real quick. Belong, or believe, and behave. I don't know if you've heard these words before, kind of used together. It's not original to me. Hi, I'm Carson. Hello.
Carson, I'm Dave.
Hi, Dave. I understand you've been on a parking lot.
Oh, yes. Six lanes into one lane.
That's a lot. Pardon me. These three words were actually first introduced to me by a New Testament scholar 50 years ago in a book printed in the 70s. It was called Evangelism in the New Testament. And the Michael Green was his name. British guy. He wrote that conversion takes all three of these things. You come to a new way of believing, and you come to belong, community, and then there's an ethical move. You begin to behave in different ways if you've really been converted, then you'll see all three of these things happen. The point I want to make is that in way too many churches, and I'm not, this is not an accusation about Knight Rowe, but in a lot of churches, particularly those that are declining, what you see is something that goes like this. Whenever you start believing like us, then you can belong here. Or even maybe more strict than that, when you believe what we believe and start behaving like we think you ought to behave, then you can belong here. And what I see in thriving churches is they reorder that. They say, you belong here. You belong here. And we welcome you here. And then they work on believing, and they work on behaving, but there's never any doubt about belonging. And that's a theological frame that that I think, you know, I want you to consider. And what I see again in thriving churches is a sense of you belong here, and then we'll work out the rest. My favorite story for this was the church I served in Atlanta before I went to ACU. I had a woman call me up, say, I'm a neighbor. This is in urban Atlanta, so, you know, you can imagine. She said, can I come see you? And I said, yes. So she came and saw me and said, I'm an atheist. She was probably 25, 27 years old, had a little baby. Said, I grew up in a Baptist church. My father sexually and physically abused me. I went to the University of Georgia and studied world religion, and I became an atheist. And I said, okay. She said, I want to come to church. I said, come to church. And she says, is it okay for me to come to church? I don't really even believe. Come to church. Well, she started coming to church. And one of her hobbies was baking. Well, the women had a baking ministry, making little loaves of bread for visitors, which I thought was a horrible thing. But as ministers and elders, sometimes people do things that you don't, you know. So she got involved in that. So about week three or week four, she comes up to me laughing because she has this loaf of bread in her hand and says, guess what I got? And I said, you got a loaf of bread? She says, yeah, I baked it. So some, you know, somebody doing the visitation or welcoming ministry had welcomed her and
gave her a bread.
You know, it was just kind of one of those ironic moments. But about 3 months later, she comes and says to me, I believe now, basically. How do I come to be a part of the life of this church? You get the point, right? You've seen that. You see it here in my room. But that's the sort of thing that I'm attending to. Thriving churches are ones that are cognizant that we need to pay attention to the way culture and gospel get sometimes transferred on top of each other.
Carson, can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. What I mean by that is that we load a bunch of terms up on spiritual words, and non-believers don't know what we're talking about.
Okay.
So we can say gospel, but what does that mean to somebody who's not come to church before? or righteousness, or what does it mean to be saved? Or we have all this jargon, and we don't think about how it's heard. Or, for example, the word family. We say we're a big family. Well, most people in America don't know what a good family looks like. Most people don't grow up in a home with two parents. Most people in America don't know what a mom and a dad look like in their home. And yet we go along happily talking about families without defining what we mean by family. And that creates a barrier for people. And churches that thrive are going to think more deeply about how we express our values and reflect about, you know, are there ways in which we're culturally communicating something that we don't really intend to communicate with this? It's about like honoring mothers. No, I'll get into a hot one since I get to leave tonight. Like we get up and talk about Mother's Day and how great it is to be a mother, when many of the women in your church would like to be a mom, or they have a story or a narrative about being a mom that's not all that favorable. And we're conveying values and inadvertently communicating negative values. Is that making sense? That's not to say we can't honor the women in our church, but we might want to reappropriate Mother's Day in some new ways and think about, what does it mean to honor women heroes in our lives? Well, that gives us a little more of a place to stand, I think, and still be cognizant of the fact that there are women who'd like to be married who are not, who've been through divorce, whose kids have deserted them, who never were able to have kids, or had abortions, or lost children. You know, there's the whole, you're stepping on a minefield. That's what you're stepping into. A minefield. If you don't think that through, and people walk out of our assemblies going, you know, they don't get me. They really don't get me. So, church is paying attention to that. Thriving churches understand that salvation, when we talk about salvation or deliverance, it is not merely about being personally saved, or spiritually saved. It's also about finding deliverance and hope and life in this world. There's sort of a split sometimes in Christian circles about is God interested in the person or simply in whether or not you've got enough to eat? Something called the social gospel sometimes gets bandied about. And there's a trope, I think it has some truth to it, but it gets distorted very quickly to say liberal mainline tradition churches talk about social gospel, about feeding the poor, housing the homeless, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but never get around to talking about Jesus as being your personal savior. And conservative churches will say, well, it's all about finding Jesus, your personal savior, and it doesn't matter what you do. And we get into this little fuss about which is right. Well, thriving churches transcend that and say, yes. Yes, it all matters. It all matters to God. That God's saving work is about the whole person, your soul and your body, your personal life and your well-being in this world. That God cares about our bodies. He cares about our lives. He cares about our relationship. So that's one thing that's sort of striking to me, is churches paying attention to the whole person. Churches that are thriving today tend to be more diverse. Our world is diverse, and churches that are thriving will foster diversity. And they're churches that pay attention to the Trinitarian nature of God. What do I mean by that? If we were to look kind of at churches broadly across the spectrum, we would find like mainline, why I'm caricaturizing here broadly, you'll give me that, or cut me some slack on this. But mainline denominations tend to honor or think about God the Father. And evangelical churches are going to talk about Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. And Pentecostal churches are going to talk about the Holy Spirit. Right? And actually, I've wondered if you couldn't do a sort of an analysis of all, you know, how do Presbyterians think? And how do Methodists think? And kind of look at what part of the Trinity they emphasize. But what I want to say is that healthy churches are ones who are, as best they can, attending to the fullness of God's being. And this is a subtle way, when I talk to Church of Christ folk, which is what I do, is to say, don't forget the Holy Spirit. Right? We want to talk about being saved, being baptized in Christ. We're in Christ. I'm all, yes. But let's not forget that the Spirit of God is at work in our world. And He's present. That this God that we serve is actually present in our world. One of the biggest things that I think churches struggle with is what I call a functional atheism. We say we believe in God, but then we act like we don't. We act like it's all up to us. This gets to our conversation earlier today. We act like it's up to us to see the success of our congregation when it's actually God's people to begin with. And if we would pay more attention to God's action in the world, right? So a healthy, lively, paying attention to the fullness of God, Father, Son, and Spirit, and letting God be the leader of our churches is things we see in churches that are thriving. Churches that are thriving, if I were to shift out of theology to more of a, what I'm calling a sense of, let's just call it a sense of location. The churches that are thriving are paying attention to their community or communities. The day of a regional church, where a church has the best worship ministry and people drive from all over the city because they've got the greatest praise band, or they've got the greatest whatever, or they've got the greatest preacher. Those days are kind of over for most churches. Now, this does not play itself out for mega churches, but the day of mega churches is not over, but we're not going to see the rise of Lot. The challenge for McNight Road is not to become a mega church. So that there's another set of rules that apply there. For 90% of all churches, what I'm saying applies. Which is, don't think about being a regional. Don't try to save all of St. Louis. Find your neighborhood or hoods. And that can be challenging because you guys are spread. But if you kind of diffusely say we are here for St. Louis, you're never going to figure out your spot. Churches that are thriving have their own parish. That word strikes. It's kind of a Catholic or a British, sometimes Anglican kind of term. But by parish, I mean you stake out some real territory. What is it? Is it south of I-44 or north of I-44? You know, what is our spot or spots? And that's where we're going to do our ministry in these spaces. These are the schools we're going to work with. These are the places where we're going to do ministry.
Is that, say a little bit more about this one, because I think this is poignant, because we really have been a metro church. We've had people coming from Illinois, from Jefferson County, St. Charles across the river, and we, and then COVID kind of shook all that up, and a lot of people said, $4.50 for gas, and we're not driving in, and and why should they make an hour drive to come here? So a lot of that turnover applies, but then when we look at here, we're kind of all spread out a bit ourselves, and so we have gone from 25 years ago, let's say, where we were neighborhood, pretty much in 3 or 4 or 5 miles from the building, to now, I think we got yard signs for the Easter Sunday, and there were 16 families that we could kind of note within this area. So now, how do you build a parish out of that?
This is the challenge, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the challenge.
Because to build a parish, you have to tell people where they're going to live.
Well, and there are some churches that are thriving that are saying, if you're moving, move to this neighborhood.
Right.
And there are churches in Dallas that are actually taking up subdivisions. And so that they don't have, half of the subdivisions, they're church people. And they're having small group in their cul-de-sacs, right?
Yeah.
Well, that sort of begins to look a little different in terms of because frankly,
community,
if you live 30 minutes from here, you're probably not going to get your neighbor to drive 30 minutes to come to this church.
No.
Mm-hmm. Not only that, we have on this corner right here, one edge of Ladue, which is the highest per capita income area. Mm-hmm. We have Brentwood and Rock Hill, which are very middle class. Mm-hmm. And then you go to North Webster, you got the historic black area where the slaves, you know, were, and a very poor economic, you know, place. And yet, the thing that I think we have done in the past, I've sat there and passed communion when we had a CEO of a Fortune 500 company on one end of the pew and a black widow, you know, sitting on the other end of the pew. But, you know, with taking communion together,
right?
Which to me was always an affirmation. I think we're doing something right. But to look at our situation now, though, it's the younger generation that's just walking away without even saying goodbye, who are looking for a new experience, and that's where personally I'm befuddled, because it's like, I get all that, and you know, to me, make it even personal, I have an 18-year-old granddaughter who might end up at ACU this year, or next year when she graduates. Her father went to ACU, and her mother went to Lipscomb, but she's 18 years old, and she's not baptized. And her father's got a PhD, and you know,
these are nuts. These are smart people, right?
Well, you know, when I try to, you know, bring these things up, you know, it's like, don't start, you know,
pushing.
I'm told, you know, back off, you know. And I'm thinking, where did we miss the teaching that believe, belong, and behave is, you know, what the gospel is all about?
Right.
I think it's important too. I appreciate you talking about the order of those three V's, because sometimes if someone walks in to our church and they're dramatically different, their lifestyle is dramatically different, maybe even they're confused about what God's called in terms of their gender identity, right? And I think there's pressure to adjust the behavior right away. There's pressure to adjust the behavior right away before you acknowledge it belong, because people will say, you know, they can't belong because, you know, what they believe and how they live their lifestyle. So they can, we can't say they belong. And so so you got that external pressure from members and trying to help them understand, hey, we want them to feel like they belong first. And in their mind, that's disorder. You know, some disorder there in terms of how. And so you create the friction a little bit between leadership and congruence, because they want something done with that person. So I think one of the challenges, how you help the congregation to order this in a way, you know, so that when someone walks in, they feel that belonging from the congregation, you know, and as opposed to feeling like, okay, you can be here, but we got to deal with some things first.
You know?
So how do you help people to in terms of to see this order and bring them in line so that they can. We can all be singing from the same
source. That's right. This starts to shift the conversation to yet another, if I put this on hold a little, but go to this, another dimension that I want to raise tonight is that thriving churches are paying attention to formation and or discipleship. I can use several words for this, but we cannot assume that what we are doing in our Sunday school programs and in our youth programs and how we're helping parents grow up children is actually working. Because it ain't.
It's not working, that's for sure.
It's not. So this is a question about how do we form people to appropriate this kind of framework a little differently than they are, because somehow or another we've missed it along the way.
Yes,
right? Somehow or another, thought the real marks of a disciple has to do with, you know, purity law rather than John 8 and Jesus being able to say, "Are you without sin?" Let's hold on here. Right? It's not that Jesus didn't think sin was important, but he took a posture, right, a posture of care, a belonging with the woman who was brought before. For an example, right? So formation or discipleship. And I think one of the things I would want to say that I observe are complete kinds of reimagination of what does it mean for us to form our children. How do we pass on the faith that was once delivered to all the saints? 1 Corinthians 15. How do we pass on the faith? And just assuming that just because we have a Sunday school program or that we have a youth minister or that we've got good vans and we take them to camp, or I'm meddling now, I'm getting out of your space.
Right. Hey, wait a minute. Right.
We can't just assume it, so there's something there. And then what do we do with our adults and to people who come to faith late? And so in some churches that means reimagining those. We have these practices, but are the practices, we need to take a deeper look at our practices, right? And I think that sometimes it also means, I don't mean to push on Jeff or others who preach here, but what are we doing with our preaching? Though I want to be very quick to say, can't this rest on preaching alone, right? But until we can see people come to the point of being able to tell the story of the gospel, or if I could take three or four more minutes on this, I would take us back into the 4th century of the church, which was a pagan time, secular time, in the time leading up before Christianity became sort of the official state religion of the late Roman Empire. There was a process of discipleship then known as catechesis. It's a $64 word for this. And what is amazing about that time was that when people wanted to be Christian, they didn't baptize them right away. They said, great, now let's enroll you into this program of study. And by the way, on Tuesdays, you're coming for Bible study. And on Thursdays, you're going to show up because we're going to go feed the widows. And so they basically taught the faith to these folks for over a year. And then finally they'd gather them all up and on Easter Sunday they'd baptize them all and dunk them, right? And they'd take off their old robes and walk into the baptistry naked. Don't ask me, but there's a lot of symbolism here. And then they'd give them a new robe out the other side of the baptistry and into the assembly, and they'd take communion for the first. But there was a quite elaborate sort of process of what it meant to be a Christian. We assume way too quickly and sort of in an evangelist sort of mode. We get somebody baptized and then we're done with them. And we kind of leave it haphazardly to maybe they show up to Sunday school, maybe they don't. So there's a lot of work here for us to do in most of our churches. And that's why I think we see people behaving badly when somebody comes in to your scenario. Or they behave badly when they start bringing their politics to church, right? They begin to behave badly when elders have to make here's what we're going to do about masks or not mask. That didn't happen here, did it?
No.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
People behave badly because they've been formed poorly. And we assume too much. So I'm raising something. We don't have time to kind of explore that, but that's one of the key things is we've got some work to help people truly know what it is that Christians believe, mm-hmm. and what it means to belong, mm-hmm. and what true Christian ethics behavior looks like. Mm-hmm. Yes, Christian behavior has sexual ethics mm-hmm. involved in it. It also means being kind to one another. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, but so that's a thing. And if there was one thing, in fact, I think I'm right. We published a newsletter out of the Cyber Institute. I think it's the next one that comes out. I've got a piece on this idea of discipleship or formation. Kind of ranting about that a little bit because I see this a lot in churches. I don't know if that kind of speaks into that.
It's very helpful. Thank you. Thank you.
To get back to this, this is a tough one. So what I see churches doing that are scattered, like you all are, is either making a choice that we are scattered, but we're going to invest our energies in one or two places. And we're going to come in to the Webster area, or we're going to come into this school district. And I know you live here, but this is our thing. And you make that choice based on some of it, several factors, proximity to your building, to sense of mission and purpose, to what God maybe positioned you to do, right, through much prayer and discernment. Or you flip it and you depower the building. And you say, well, actually, we look at the map, there are six broad areas in this city where we do sort of gather, and we're going to depower what happens here. We're going to move ministry to those neighborhoods in those parts of the city, with the idea that almost like house churches begin to rise up. Is that, I'm not saying one or the other, but just to say, so that you're not driving 30 minutes into the building for every little thing, but you're driving 7 minutes to a brother or sister, somebody's house, and you're launching something there, and you all have adopted a school in your neighborhood, and you're doing something there. Or you're doing like a church in North Carolina that they started doing this, and so this group out in this far-flung neighborhood started having a series of small group meetings in the YMCA. And next thing you know, they got all kinds of the public going, what's going on? Oh, Bible study. Come on in. Well, and so they were doing their thing there, even though their building was 30 minutes away. But that'll lead you down a different kind of path than thinking about
what's next. Then.
Right. Yeah. Basketball league. Well, what about out here where we live? And that's not to say you can't do both, but you're going to need to decide where your future lies.
And would you say that it's imperative we decide? Because we've gone quite a while without deciding.
Right.
But it hasn't really led in a good direction. But I'm
right.
Just like, with what degree of emphasis would you say this is critical?
I think it's very critical, and here's why. Faith travels through relationship. Mm. And if you're spending all your time driving back and forth across the city and not in people's homes or in coffee shops are good, or can I say it, bars are good, or other, there's another church bought a laundromat in the neighborhood, started running it, had all their older folk who were retired staff the laundromat and they created an extra large areas. So they could have Bible studies and prayer meetings right there in the neighborhood while people were washing their clothes in lower income neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. But they were creating spaces for people to interact with people. That's where God does his work.
I think that's a huge, hugely important statement.
So faith
travels through relationships. And I think it is one of our glaring inabilities at this point is to do much more than Sunday morning gathering. And it's too diffuse and it's so weak at the end of the day that it's no wonder that we're struggling.
Right. So these thriving churches often are, just to get to this a little more, are actually really, really rather simple. My guess is that McKnight Road is much more complex than a church that started 10 or less years ago and is blowing and going. Because what they'll have is assemblies, in plural, on Sundays. They'll drive people into small group ministries or prayer ministries where they're in groups of 10 or 12. And they have some sort of children youth program.
That's it. Yeah.
End of story. But we think, oh no, we need to have, I'm picking on this. I don't really mean this. We've got to have the basketball league. We've got to have the widows group. We've got to have this. We've got to have that. And this is what happens with established churches, because these things come up over time. And in our polity in Churches of Christ, we have taken the posture, which, perfect, but this worked 20 years ago. If Sister Sue has got a good idea for a ministry, we said, go sick them, Sue, do it. And we're going to provide that. But for everything that gets pulled this way or that way, we're not launching new groups in neighborhoods that tell people about Jesus. Is that, I'm picking, but I don't mean to be picking.
No, no, I think you're. It's kind of ironically relevant to very recent meetings because we've had a proposal from Sister Sue, but I think it's not actually that relevant if we haven't defined the other. In other words, it's only relevant as a negative, as a negating. If we could say positively what we are, then we can say what we're not. But if we can't say what we are with some real articulation and clarity so that she understands it and we understand it, then it makes no sense. It just hurts feelings.
Why not do what she wants to
do? Exactly.
Because it's as good as anything else.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. And so one of the, this could be another thing that's in my notes here, is that churches that are thriving have clarity of mission over maintenance. Mm-hmm. Mission over maintenance. And so the clearer you can articulate the reason why we exist, the better off and better postured you are, because you will be able to decide that is a good thing, but it doesn't help us with this. Or it's a good thing, and that's exactly a step toward this.
And so you can almost say that we are an effective communicators to the congregation, helping them to see who we are and what we're trying to do. When sisters, theoretical, when Sister Sue comes to us and says, I want to do this, it's supporting what we establish as a priority, as we see God's calling us to, as something outside of those bounds. And so it seems to me that if the congregation is all on the same page, that when they come and talk about, I want to do this, it's not going to be something that's going to detract.
Right.
It's going to be something that's going to add or expand what you're already doing. Mm-hmm. So it makes the decision to do that particular thing a little easier.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which is one thing with COVID, we were able to pare down some ministries that we didn't need.
Yeah.
That was a good thing.
Yeah. That's right.
Pare down some of the people that
That's right. I'm working at the church. I'm in year four now in a consultative relationship with the church in San Antonio. And an established church. It began right after World War II, like late 40s. At one time was 800, 900 members. Now down to about 100. Well, when I started working, about 175. It's now down to about 125.
Yeah.
We're making progress. Well, actually, we're kind of are, because although the church is down to that, there's about 80 people in the community that are worshiping in a second service now.
Huh.
So actually, in terms of the numbers, it's actually a little more. But we were doing this kind of vision work. So one of the things they did was we went through and we identified every ministry that was going on in that church. They had 150 ministries. Now they were counting everything, like the junior high program and the senior high program. But the point, but my guess is most established churches have got this wide array.
Yeah.
And that sucks a lot of, at one point those were life-giving. Today, some of them are life-giving. Some of them are life-taking. And a lot of them are just in the way. They're in the way. And so one of the things I've got to say to you is it's a real challenge for an established church to sort of find renewal by God's grace to lead into kind of and it will take a clear, very clear vision, which is what's happening in this church. It's been a four-year journey, and it's emerging for them.
Would you say, Carson, that the vision precedes the simplification? In other words, and I think when you were talking a little earlier, it sounded like a Tom Simple Faith, Simple Church, I think it's called,
yeah.
Tom Rainier book.
Tom Rainier, yeah.
It's kind of the ABC. I mean, you meet in the assembly, you meet in the small groups, and I forgot what the third.
Probably ministry development, one
area to serve, which is really kind of consistent with our delight in God, encourage one another, serve eagerly. Okay, that's what it's on our signs and all that. But then we've kind of got it overlaid all these other ministries, and then a kind of a philosophy, if you've got an idea,
bring it,
you know, that's been a long-standing part of the priesthood of all believers, which would say everybody's kind of got a gift to contribute, and so it's hard to mesh all those. help me out here.
So what does it mean for some of that kind of ministry to take place? I assume you've got a small group.
We do a small group of ministries, yes.
So, or a Bible schools classes. So can some of that stuff be located in other places rather than it all coming in here and then back out? So that's a Sunday school activity to do this thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Sister Sue wants to deliver... Yeah. You know, baskets of apples to...
Rather than here, it could be a small group or whatever,
right.
Connect group
owns
that.
Sue, talk to your Sunday school. Would they join you in this?
Yeah.
And you kind of push it back out from staff and elders, because you've got another piece of work to do. You know, you guys are supposed to be praying and spending in the Word, Acts 6, right? Mm-hmm. And trying to define it a little that way is one thing. But... it's back again to how clear are we about our mission.
And on that, Carson, I was wondering, you know, and part of this, so, you know, usually the clarity of purpose comes from the pulpit. And we've got a great pulpit minister, and so let's say we're trying to clarify that, restructure that, but we understand our pulpit minister may only have a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're making him the focus, and then he's, in a year, he's gone. And so... how do you do that without the congregation's who's the mouthpiece? You know, really, what are we saying? And, you know, why is he talking all this and now he's gone? And so, I mean, I hear what you're saying. It's just...
you ran him out of town!
I'm just thinking now, you know, you work on this for a year, and then
how
does that transition work if he's the focal point of all that?
Well, I don't have a pristine answer, but some of the moving pieces of that, I think, would be what if we understand, we can think about vision as being something that comes from one person into a church through Jeff. Right? Jeff, give us the vision, and we'll follow, right? Or we can say, in light of the fact that we've got to help move a whole church, let's reimagine how we clarify that vision or the mission. We're using terms that are slip-slidey. We need to decide what it is we're really, what do we mean by these terms. But what would it be like that to call maybe a group of people in the church into a process of identifying that vision or mission? That would include elders, some staff, and some of the congregation itself, and what I've done this with a number of churches, this model. I've done different models in different places, but thinking about some of the dynamics here, you create a vision team, and it may take them a year to do what I'm describing, but they spend some time looking deeply at the context of St. Louis and this in the congregation, the gifting, and the resources that God has placed here, looking at... the larger context of the city and how do we attend to those things, and let a vision sort of emerge from this group of, these are often kind of unwieldy things, and they take a while, but maybe it's a couple, 3 dozen people doing this work, who are, by the way, key leaders or...
Influencers,
opinion leaders in the church. So if you get 3 dozen people sort of finally rallying around, you're going to have quite a strong force beyond the elders and staff to kind of move that momentum into a new future, maybe with a new minister by that point in time. I don't know if that's... that would be one way I begin to want to play with all of that. That may not be very helpful. But
yeah, and I hear you. I struggle with... group projects, and
yeah.
you know, you get more than 12 people, and you're going to have all kinds of people going different ways.
Yes.
And it generally, in my experience, it tends to put people off. It's like, they didn't listen to me. This isn't what I wanted.
Right.
And it tends to be more divisive.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there may be ways to work around that, mm-hmm. but, and so I just, in my head, try to struggle. How do you work that?
I could play that out and kind of give some counter thought to that. But let me just back up and say another approach to that is to begin to think, okay, Jeff, what is your timeline? What is the church's timeline? And then begin to say, what we may not be able to fully articulate a vision today, but what kinds of things can we do to set the groundwork? And we're going to do those groundwork pieces. And then as Jeff concludes his work, we move into a clear set time of transition. Then how do we move into that? And how do we call a new lead minister to come alongside us to help fine-tune that vision? And so that gets us into, Jeff, I'm talking, I think, out of turn. We could say some things about transition tonight as well. So
we talked about that in brief as well, just the whole, I can't remember what I put in the email, but something to the effect of in the next year or two, and just what that would take, since we haven't been through that process for a long time in terms of sort of the senior minister role, or whatever we want to call the person, what you're seeing in terms of that how to go about that transition, and how challenging or not will that be for us.
So I wouldn't mind playing some of that out a little more in a bit, if that would be helpful as well.
Any generational studies or data that you're seeing about millennials and downward as to percentages of people that are, it seems like all the churches are having the same issues.
Yes.
And I think it's a culture war myself, but.
Well, it's related to several factors, but probably persons under 40, say under the age of 40, nearly 40% of them classify themselves as nuns. That is, they have no particular faith. There's a new book out just a couple of months ago. I wrote about it in a newsletter piece by Stephen Bullivant. And he says it's more complex than that, that of those 40% that are nuns today, some of them have never really been religious at all. They grew up in a non-religious home. But many of them are what he calls nonverts. He coins a term. They were Baptist or Church of Christ or Mormon or Catholic, but they have been so distanced from their faith heritage, they have unconverted, they've nonverted. Mm. And they have a particular arm's lengthness to faith because they have found it noxious in some way or another. So it's even more sobering than they don't go to church. No, they don't go to church, and they've got stories about why they don't go to church.
Yep.
So to be a bearer of good news, to your point. So if we're talking about young adults, we've got our work cut out for us. And my sense about that is that there are several points that we need to attend to in that as leaders. One is we need to make sure that our children that we do have in our care, are we attending to them in healthy ways, as we talked about a moment ago? And then, are we prepared to enter into those ambiguous spaces where these nuns inhabit, which are not churches? They're coffee shops and bars and laundromats and other public spaces.
There was a Baptist church here a few years ago that set up a Bible study at a brewery.
Yeah.
It worked great for about 2 years. I think it fizzled away. But
They were experimenting with this space. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the Baptist church told them they couldn't do it anymore, they turned it into a community church.
My 35-year-old daughter talks about living in Nashville and as a grad student, and there was a a brewery that had hymn night, and she's, you know, 300 people would show up and have craft brew beers
and sing hymns
and sing. They passed out hymn books, and these people with a piano, they find their tune, and she said it was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, that seems a little weird for us, but it tells me something. It tells me that these folks
are missing us all.
There's something, yeah. they know that there is something transcendent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they also know that the last place they would look is in the church, which is, that's,
yeah.
We can say, no. But that's the perception they have. And you can argue all day long, but you're not going to, with that perception.
It's the, you know, elders' kids or the, you know, preachers' kids with the stories having, you know, don't want anything to do with what mom and dad did at all. And, you know, we've all seen that. And, you know.
So how do we find to get into those kinds of spaces and signal that we understand transcendence and we're willing to live in that ambiguous space and find ways of connecting with folk like that? Yeah, before I left Atlanta, I had a Sunday night in a pizza/pub with 20-somethings of Bible study. We called it Theology on Tap. And there were about 6 or 8 of my people there, but there'd be 20 people that they knew. And they'd gather, and we'd have Bible study in the corner of a pub. And it was amazing. It's like, so you're a pastor and you're sitting in here? Yeah. What do you want to talk about tonight? And away we'd go. And so finding ways into those spaces, I think, matter. And then we've got to attend to our worship itself and make sure that we're not inadvertently saying things or doing things there to push people away. Like the Mother's Day thing I was doing earlier, right? Or the kind of language we're using. So the nuns is the thing. And it's why in Churches of Christ we're closing about 9 or 10 churches a month. And Baptist churches are closing hundreds of, you know, dozens of churches a month. And so are all the other church traditions. With maybe not the Pentecostals and maybe not Hispanic Catholics. But by and large, we're in a time of rapid shift. And it's not a time for us to panic. It's a time for us to be intentional. And so what I want to encourage is intentionality toward a clear mission.
You talk about your own kids here. I think my Jewish friends, you know, the whole idea of bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, is that at the age of 12, they're entered into the congregation as members, and the families, you know, celebrate, and they become Jewish, you know. I think, you know, we don't have anything close to that. And of course, my Jewish friends also, there's the Reform and then the Conservative liberal who don't even know who God is, you know.
Right.
But it's funny how the same issues, you know, roll of women, music, name it. Cuts across
people
all those lines.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So Carson, would you classify, you kind of said the Pentecostal churches are kind of an outlier of some of these kind of
some places.
Churches.
Yeah.
So would you classify them as a thriving congregation, or are they doing some of these things that thriving congregations are doing, or is there something else going on there that, you know,
with
causing Pentecostal churches to maintain their?
Yeah, there are some. It's not altogether clear, but there's some data that says that among some Pentecostal churches, there is significant growth happening. And I think it's tied to simply a deep connection to the Holy Spirit and their willingness to live into those kind of spaces. And some of us as Americans are like, oh, that's a little too, you know, a little spooky. We're not going to go there. You've probably been paying attention to what happened at Asbury about a month ago with a revival there. And that's what's been amazing to me about that is how many people have felt like they needed to weigh in on that and say, that was good, or there's something wrong with that. rather than
we
to say
in frontier revivalism.
Why not just say it is what it is? God was at work. But we tend to be suspicious of that. And I think among some Pentecostal groups, charismatic, they've kind of pushed past that and willing to say, you know, God's at work in all kinds of ways. It's not clear to me yet about fully in the data whether they're really growing or whether there's been some evidence of that.
Okay. Can we take a 2-minute break to run down the hall and then I don't want to miss anything.
Now you say it. Nice.
I was.
For those of you big planners, just go
ahead. And what would be, I didn't really clarify at the beginning, what a fair ending time was. 8:45, would that be okay? I didn't.
I'm retired, I don't care.
I want to be conscious of.
Yeah, Vicky, my wife, said, when are you going to be back? And I said, well, if I'm not back by midnight, send out a search party.
We got started a little late, and Dave and some others came in late, but maybe shoot for, which only gives us 30 minutes, that's not very much, but Walker over there has got to drive home. You're good?
Carson, I just want to say, it's been several months ago, but we were preparing to deliver sort of to the congregation our thoughts about our values. We selected 7 values.
Yeah.
During that, we each sort of took one of those values and used it to present to the congregation.
Right.
And I came across one of your articles. Steve actually sent it to me. And it was just very powerful. It was just at the right time.
Hmm.
It was one where it was talking about, you know, we're not going to be known for the greatest preacher. We're not going to be known for the greatest worship leader or the worship service.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be known by being a church that really is attentive to the needs of our community, whether that's in providing food, providing counseling, providing whatever is needed.
Yeah.
And it was just great timing for me, and it really has impacted me since then to really think about what's important, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we can get so off track sometimes about thinking this has really been good, just to really go back to what are a handful of key foundational things that we could focus on that really will do what church is meant to be, you know.
Yeah.
And
and
not get caught up in the
that's
administration
well
and
said.
Yeah.
But that was, it was just a very wonderful article and impactful.
That's, thanks. Yeah. There's, there are these things that, these are the things that matter, it seems to me, that having a clear target, where are we headed? We're headed to Minneapolis. Our vision is, well, how are we going to get there? There's a lot of ways to go to Minneapolis from here. But what's our particular route that we're going to take? That's our vision. And then in what way will we travel along with one another to do that? And that's these values, right?
Mm-hmm.
What fuels us is we care about people. And we're not going to let anybody fall off the wagon as we make our way. Whether we go through Chicago or we go through Des Moines or, you know, whatever our way is that we've decided. And then part of the work of leaders is simply making sure that everything is intentional and that our job is to create the appropriate amount of urgency for our congregation, which is kind of like cooking chili on a stove. I talked about chili this morning. A good pot of chili needs some time on the stove, right? But you got to get just the right amount of heat, not too much or it'll burn, and too little it doesn't get that little bubble going on. And the job of leaders is to just keep the right amount of urgency that kind of drives us forward. So that's great, being able to identify a set of values. These are the things that matter to us as a part of all of this. And so you've done a lot of, you've done some really important work by having done that.
Something I'm trying to also figure out is we want to be a thriving church, but I don't know if it's like civilization. You can't define it, but you know it when you see it. So, you know, there's big churches. you know, but are they thriving? You know, you come home on a Sunday and you're exhausted. It's like, you know, and, you know, is that thriving? You know, everybody's just going 100 miles an hour. You know, you don't want to be a small church, but what is a thriving church? Sure. And, you know, hopefully there's a sense of community. You know, hopefully, you know, we're teaching values and we're helping people. But, I mean, it's hard to define it for me, you know, because usually you think in numbers, you know, we need more people, but is that, you know, thriving really? Right. What is that?
Right. Yeah, I would say if there were two things, this is, goes back to some things I said this morning that Steve and Jeff heard me say, so I'll repeat.
Oh, you're fine. Please.
But if a church has a clear sense of mission, vision, and values, and it's living those things out, that's, and the second piece of that is that it's created a sustainable way of being in the world, then it's doing its work. That's a thriving church. And I say sustainability because you can't stay on mission and stay and attend to things if you don't have the necessary both financial resources, which is the first thing you'd think about, right? But there are other sustainable kinds of
structure, leadership structure, facility.
The right kind of staff to attend to things, a leadership governing structure, elders. If you have, I did the bowl thing. So the chili, right? So the chili is what's good, but you got to have the bowl to put it in. So the chili, in essence, is the mission, but you got to have the bowl. And so having both of those things, mission, vision, and values, and the sustainability, then I think you've got a healthy, thriving church. Will it be huge? It may or may not be. I don't think there's any award that goes to being a really big church. But a church that's on mission, that's outwardly focused, we'll see growth, I think. I know that tomato plants aren't really a tomato plant until they reproduce tomatoes. And so are we forming Christian people? It becomes, you know, part of the test. So is that helpful?
Yes.
Think about that. Mm-hmm. I think often churches tend to begin in times of trouble. The urgency gives way to anxiety, which is a little different thing than urgency. Mm-hmm. And so we begin to worry, and we tend to want to turn inward. And we lose sight of the fact that we've been given the job the church is for the world, right? The church, God called us as a people, not to ourselves, but for the sake of the world. For the sake of the world is such a powerful notion. And that's where I see a lot of churches, they turn inward. And that's not a healthy place.
When in the churches you've seen that are doing this well, the mission seems like it's pretty well laid out in the New Testament in terms of making disciples. Our particular way of putting it is welcoming others into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what we've got on the wall. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how many members could say it, but most everybody has seen it, and some could say it. Mm-hmm. We have our seven values. The vision has been harder, and we struggled with this kind of prior to COVID, now got a little bit sidetracked, as it related to a focus on the next generation. Mm-hmm. That was where we've, in fact, we raised our hiring, and meaning spending part of a greater portion of our budget to say we need a full-time children's minister,
right?
And as well as a youth minister, and that's something we've never had in the history.
Right.
Of the congregation, and we've tried to work with kind of establishing milestones for the development of our children. A lot of talk around that. I don't know that we've gotten it ever communicated well to the congregation,
right.
And or whether that whole next gen focus has always if it's always actually even resonated fully with all of us, nor does it seem like it resonates immediately with the congregation. But all right. that to say is that's the closest thing I think that we've been able to come to say this is our vision is related to reaching that next generation.
Right. That's the way.
And it's probably our weakest part of our, I mean, if you look out, I had a guy that was the urban minister in Tulsa or Oklahoma City call me a couple weeks ago because his daughter and son-in-law just moved. He just took a job at Boeing. And he said, they're here, they're in town. He said, I'm coming in this weekend. We're thinking about going to church at McKnight. And he said, tell me about your 20-something group. And because they want relationships. You know, that the most important thing for them is relationships. And by the time I finished the conversation, I was such a good evangelist. He said, well, maybe we'll find another congregation to go to this Sunday. Because I just didn't have a story to tell around that group. Now, I saw a couple of couples, new couples this past weekend again. So there are probably a few lingering out there, but how to get all that banded together, I don't know. My point being, tell me what that vision sounds like in particular. I know it's kind of pointed, and you maybe not be able to recall these, but or where we would go to kind of see that, because it gets as much as I've sort of wrestled and struggled with this, I don't think it's ever gotten super plain to me what, or even through this, you know, this collective process, having a retreat together, we've done that multiple times and try to sort of work through some of this, and we will be able to get some action steps out of it, but we can't ever quite articulate very well what the vision is. Is this fair, guys?
Yeah. So what percentage, I'm going to ask some seemingly unrelated questions. What percentage of your budget is to staff?
60%.
Okay, that's actually a pretty good number. And you've made some new hires just recently. Yes. Right. So,
I'm thinking. No, you're fine. I've got to put you on the spot there.
Yeah. Processing. So, part of this is being able to articulate that in a way that puts values, vision, and mission sort of in a matrix or in a way
where trajectory, so to speak, yes.
So being really clear that these staff hires and this focus on intergenerationality or children and youth really matter for us.
Yes.
For the next generation. This is how we're making disciples and relationships with Jesus, your mission statement.
Forming relationships, yes. Yeah, welcoming others into
how are we telling that story? Well, and you may have done these kinds of things.
Not well. I don't think we've done pieces and parts at different settings, but I don't know that we've. I don't think it's a part of the collective conscience.
Right. So
in a good way.
You know, by fall, can you clarify some of those things and then have a time where there's a series of messages where you have the children and youth minister part of this, where we're articulating that, and the elders are blessing it, right, and affirming that. This is our vision for this church. This is a church for young people. We want to form these children and these teenagers, and we got to find a way to tend to these young adults.
Right.
Right. That's our path toward this larger thing. So how are we telling that story and reinforcing that story?
I think even the activities are there, more or less. I mean, this past Sunday we did the first time ever, and the children's minister was doing a fantastic job that we just hired last spring, planned the bowling time as a congregation. Mm-hmm. So it's a community event. First time we've ever done this. Well, we had 85 people show
young
up.
Young and old there.
Young and old, and it was all kinds of laughter.
For we there.
A third. I mean, we're probably 250.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, on Sundays, we have 200, but but there are more members than that. Okay. But yeah, we do that, the math by that, it's probably 300 members. But 85, that was a good turnout for this event.
Yeah.
And it was a family event, and it was all generational, and there was just lots of laughter on every lane, and nobody much bowled over about, I don't know what you bowled, Brett.
Let's not talk about it. I didn't break 100.
So, and then we've got a family retreat, we were calling it, and then we realized that's not a good term. We're going to not use that. Just within the last, and said this is a church retreat down at our camp Neotes at the end of April. And again, we've got a committee that's working on that. Staff is involved, but it's mostly non-staff people that are trying to pull together. So there's a lot of, and then we're the fifth Sunday of every quarter. You know, on the fifth Sunday months with five Sundays, we're involving the children's ministry to make the worship service actually more intergenerational.
Right.
We've done well at incorporating our teens into being on the praise team, reading scripture, sharing the communion. I think these are things that are all obvious to the congregation. So in one sense, it might have more to do with telling the story well than the activities themselves. And that is, I'm kind of arriving at this as we're talking, it seems like the time, it's so limited in terms of when we're actually together to communicate this. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's 10 minutes of announcements to try to explain this, and then you have 65 minutes, and that really is one email a month, one email a week that goes out to everybody. But we don't have on Wednesday nights, we've got some small groups that meet up here, some teams. So there isn't a whole program because it just was become ineffective. There's not a Sunday night time to gather. So how do you get that communicated in that 65-minute session?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say that's where, in some ways, better defining that story and then communicating it. Probably most of the pieces are there. Help me, guys, if you think if that's right or wrong. And then I think it's readjusting even then what you expect to happen from that. Because I think you can still do most of those things and have very little relevance to the community right around us.
Well, that becomes the challenge. It's kind of a both and that's really hard to attend to. One of the things that I'm not hearing in all of that, but I would want to weave into that is how does the staff here actually invite the parents into the passing on of the faith to our children? And so what kind of, is that a curricular kind of thing that we attend to?
Yeah.
Is it a weekly video?
There is stuff that goes out with each session, each week.
Yeah.
And then right now, one of the guys in our congregation who's a fantastic family man and Matthew Bardwell, he and I are doing a class on baptism that was attended but part of the intent of the class is how do we think about baptism, and that we've kind of using Childers' ideas, some of his ideas that we've talked about it a lot in some ways and very, very little in other ways. And so, again, the idea of the class was to a refresher for ourselves. However, it's even more than that. How do we pass on our faith is embedded in that to our children. So, that class we just started last
summer. And the children's ministry and the youth ministry are using the Gospel Project together so that they can have discussions at home.
Yep. Yep.
That's great.
Yeah.
No, I think that's good. It doesn't attend to this other, is there a way to think both kind of an inward movement and an outward movement about what does it mean to back to your mission statement? What was your mission statement?
Welcoming others into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. It does sort of implied it's an attractional model to a certain degree based on that mission statement. And maybe that doesn't get to the going out, being sent idea, as well as some other statement could.
Mm-hmm.
and I think part of what we're doing now is we're trying to regroup our community because of COVID, mm-hmm. so that we can have some strong community here to be able to go out with. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we may have said this before, but to me, back to our statements about belonging and the importance of making sure people that are new here feel that belonging. I think even for our members, I think it's hard, at least in my mind, to think that they feel like they belong here. You know, it's, if we as each member felt like we belong here, I think we'd have a whole different level of participation and engagement and all of that. Whereas it almost becomes, I think, a lot of times kind of rote that, you know, I come, I go to church, as Jeff said, Sunday morning, and and go home, and then nothing much until next Sunday morning.
Yeah, right.
So that sense of belonging, I think, is as important for the member as it is for that
new person coming in.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And if we could get people to feel like they really belong here, because there's a purpose for them here, something for them to engage in here, and
then one way to think about these next 1 or 2 years would be, I kind of want to transition to transition.
Yeah, great.
Is how do we utilize these next 2 years, not so much to re-envision a new vision, but how do we attend to behave, belong, and believe, pull on that? And where do we need to do some work?
Shore that up.
Yeah. And we're identifying in these few moments the sense of belonging. Okay, if that still holds true for you all as a community of leaders over the next few weeks, then how would we do that in these next 2 years? As we begin to think about a terminus for Jeff, and then how do we move into a transitional period? That opens up a new chapter of this church's life. If I'm moving on into questions about or conversation about transition, Jeff's long tenure here means that there will be a transition. And like you've been living in one room, and there's another room you're going to head to, but you got to go through a hall to get there to that room. And you can't really, even if you push the rooms together, you still got to cross a threshold. And in Latin, the word for threshold is liminal. And so sometimes you hear this as sort of a cool, hip, theological term, liminal space. It's a time between the times. And you'll need to go through that. If you don't go through it well, then you bring in a new person in Jeff's to be your lead minister, and then you'll go through a liminal space. And then the church and maybe you will think all of the upheaval of going through that threshold or that hall is the new guy's fault. And we're going to blame him, and he becomes an interim minister. And you don't want that, right? So thinking about a pathway into that new space very intentionally matters a great deal. And so I'm working with a church now in Albuquerque, New Mexico, that had a 20-some-odd-year veteran minister. Not a military veteran. He'd been there long tenure.
It feels like it sometimes.
Yes. Combat duty pay and everything, right? And we were talking a year or more before he announced his retirement, right? We were kind of laying this out. So this is a good time for these kinds of conversations. Some churches will seek to bring somebody on the staff and let the new lead minister or the standing lead minister and the new lead minister sort of share for a year or so. That's probably not the option I would recommend here, in part because the size of the congregation probably doesn't allow you to do that budget-wise. And sometimes it takes a couple of you can't do that quickly often. You may bring on the young new minister and it really doesn't work out. So typically what's probably better is to look at a timeline to say, you know, mutually with you and Jeff, is to say, here's where it makes sense to say we conclude Jeff's ministry. And we announce it in a proper, you know, ahead of time. We let the church sort of grieve that. Churches go through it's like stages of grief when somebody dies, right? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote this book 40 years ago about stages of grief. You get angry, and then you go through denial, and then you get sad, and then you finally kind of resign yourself, that, right?
We've kind of had that with the merger.
Yeah.
And with different ministries leaving.
We're cycle.
We're familiar with some of
that. It's and you all are wrestling with that sort of now, but the church will hear it at a certain point, and you know, they need a little time for that. So coming up with a way of letting the church go through that and then move into an interim space. And this sounds like I'm after a job, and I'm happy to talk about that, but more and more churches are using an interim program for this space. There's a group associated with Hope Network called Interim Ministry Partners who do this well, where they send someone who walks alongside you through this 9-month, maybe, time of transition. It could be longer, it could be shorter. It probably will be longer. Finding ministers today is not an easy thing to do. I can say more about that if you'd like.
Yeah, say a word. Sorry.
Well, maybe before that, am I hearing you correctly? And so we kind of talked about different things, like maybe Jeff will be around a year or two or maybe a year, and then part-time advisory. You know, he's just gifted in preaching and leadership. But what I'm hearing you saying is that's not advisable, or that's not what you would recommend. You would prefer a hard stop is kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I would. I'm actually working with another church that I really probably can't name because we're in the thick of it, with a 23-year tenured senior minister in an 800-member church, and he's staying on. In fact, he's still on, and we're in the middle of the search process, and he is a great minister. In fact, I will bring him on as a consultant in the cyber. He is in the Cyber Institute. But it's going to be hard with him there. And I have to do this, Jeff, to say
fine,
this.
That's fine.
So
you're good.
What I would say is Jeff needs to leave for a couple of years. I mean, he doesn't have to leave town, but he needs to disconnect from the church and sadly from you all, because if he's still here and you got this new guy here and things will get a little rough and you're gonna say, well, Jeff, what do you think? And you're not relying on the new guy. And that becomes really hard on the new guy. And you need to go ahead and go through it with the new guy, not with Jeff sort of being the crutch. Is that making sense? And Jeff knows he probably shouldn't get involved, but if you keep asking him, what's he gonna do? He's a good guy, he's gonna come in. And so it just creates some real awkwardness. And so having that hallway experience for a period of time, it could be a year, it could be 2 years, some season of time.
Meaning where you got your interim guy coming in. And is he actually here full time? I mean, all the time?
Yeah, the interim guy
fly in.
He typically would fly in for weekends.
Okay.
Work with you all, help you go through a process of listening to the church, do consultative work with survey work with the church, kind of ask, how would we rearrange the house? How would we set things in order to get ready for the next chapter of the church's life? So Interministry Partners does this well. We do it as well at Cyber. The Interministry Partners, a guy named Doug Peters, is their manager. You know Doug? You know who he is?
Yeah, No, I'm familiar with Interministry Partners, but not with Doug.
And I'm happy to make we brag about each other all the time. It's not a Their program's a little more extensive and programmatic. The way we do this is a little more custom based on the church, and we're probably not in as much with within our ministry partners. They will be here 3 Sundays out of 4 with you to work with the elders, appropriate time to help launch a search committee, to walk alongside the search committee, et cetera, and provide a consistent preaching presence that's not Jeff, mm-hmm. or not your children's minister or your youth mm-hmm. minister, because they need to be doing their own thing and not preparing sermons every week. Or you don't want them in the pulpit and the church begin to say, well, you know, he's pretty good. Maybe he could be our preacher. And then you've got that to deal with. Mm-hmm. He might be a preacher, but if he is, we ought to let him just apply for the job and not get into this popularity contest kind of thing. So go through an interim process with an outside source. We do that. Interministry Partners does that. That would lead to the identifying and then bringing on a new lead minister. That fits. By then, hopefully you've got believe, belong, behave, functioning, you know, a little better. You may have tweaked mission, vision, and values some through that interim space with somebody walking alongside you who acts sort of like a senior minister, saying, hey, think about this, right? Pressing or encouraging you all and others. And then you bring that new person in. And then let that new person be here 6 months or a year, and then you can ask the question, what role could Jeff play? Maybe Jeff plays this is what we're going to do in this new church, in this church environment that I can't talk about, is I'm going to recommend, in that church, it's a large church, it's got 15 staff people or more. I can't remember, it's a bunch. But we're going to have a triad. There'll be the preaching minister and then three that serve as sort of the executive team of the staff. And we're going to have the old minister serve as a consultant to them, not to the elders, but to them. And so that they are aware of the work that and the influence of that person. So there'll be a role, I think, for Jeff, but I would recommend that Jeff go see his grandkids and he finds other things to do for a year or two. And then we find a way to kind of bring him back in to let the church go through that transition and not use Jeff as a crutch, or for you all to use Jeff as a crutch, or your young staff to use Jeff as a crutch inappropriately, if that makes sense.
You know, that's different than the way I was thinking, but I will say, I wanted you guys to hear, at my work, we had a 20-plus year executive director who really grew the agency and was excellent. And when he retired, he left. We didn't ask him to be on the board of directors for 3 years. He had plenty of relationships in the community, and after about 3 years, we had an opening, he came back on the board, fit right in, it was great, but he gave that new executive director the space, and she could call him all she wanted, but he wasn't there, and I think it was a good experience, and we didn't lose him forever, and, you know, he didn't have to walk away from his life's work, but he took that break too in his new retirement, and I think it validates what you're describing. There's a win-win there, and some advantages to that, and I had not translated that into this
environment,
what we're thinking about, but it's, you know, there are a lot of elements to that that make sense validate.
Well, there are a lot of ways to think about this, and I know, Steve, you're going through this as you step out of your role. And creating some distance there to let the system adjust to life without Jeff will force the system then to attend to the new person coming in and build an honest-to-goodness relationship with that new person, not mediated by Jeff in some way, as good as Jeff is, right? Because we need that to be successful for the next full chapter of the church's life. And then we can sort out the Jeff thing. Jeff might serve as a shepherd here at some point, or serve as an, I mean, there's a lot of ways in which Jeff might serve, but I think we need to be patient about that and be attentive. You all are big people. Be able to talk to each other and think what's best, most healthy for the system, for our leadership, and find that path forward in that. So,
say what you're seeing in terms of actual ministers that are looking for positions, and who are we graduating, and would be somebody young, would be somebody, mid-season. What are the chances of that would kind of fit McKnight, et cetera?
Right. Yeah, I wish I could. This what I'm about to say is sober. We're not seeing people come out of our schools and colleges left and right to be ministers. For every 10 churches that are, or maybe it's even higher than that, for every, we probably have almost 100 churches on our job posting board at ACU that are looking for some sort of minister right now. We've got another probably 75 that ask a committee at the Cyber Institute called the Looking Team for personal help with ministers. Those are tend to be larger or a little more connected churches. So we've got about 200 churches, and it's not the same list. About 200 churches looking right now. So every month, we'll get 10 to 15 churches asking for help in one way or the other, and we'll have maybe one minister say, I'd be open to a call. So it's really out of whack. When I began with the Institute, it was more of a 5-to-5. You know, it was an even kind of ratio. For every 5 or 6 churches, I had 5 or 6 ministers saying, you know, I'd welcome a call.
They were already in ministry.
Already in ministry.
Much of the time.
And then we got a few
people ready to move.
Coming in, new ministers. But the amount of ministers are leaving ministry at a higher rate even than I think churches are closing their doors. And we don't have a lot of people going to college to be ministers. They're coming to be attorneys, or they're business people, or medical people, or engineers.
So how do we reimagine that with the reality?
Yeah, right. But I actually, interestingly, spoke at an Elder Link event in Dallas 3 weeks ago about growing your own ministry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of identifying somebody and helping prepare that person. And so, looking within the congregation or within the St. Louis area and saying, you know, here's somebody. How would we, could we send them to seminary for a while? Could we invest in whatever formative work that needs to happen for them in order that at some point in the future they could take up this role? They've got other gifts that we can see, but it'd be nice if they had an opportunity to study some Bible and some theology and, learn about homiletics or whatever those things are. A church like McKnight Crossings, I think, has a number of things going for it that will cause people to be attracted to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not in Albuquerque. I'm only picking on this church because they have been so keenly aware of this. And they're facing that now. We're now trying to actively get names. They're getting these responses. Well, yeah, we can't see ourselves living in the West. So you're in a major metropolitan area. There's a history here. There's a healthy elder group. There's a lot of things that are positive, and that's going to help draw some names. But there was a day when I began when you'd have had 150 resumes show up. Now, 130 of them wouldn't be worth really looking at, but you still had 20 or 30 good candidates. Today, I would say, if you had 4 good candidates, then that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
We saw that in youth ministry when we just hired a youth minister.
Yes. Yeah. So what I'm encouraging, church, if you find a good candidate, don't sit for 2 months waiting for a few more to come. You better all just keep on moving, because somebody else is going to see a candidate too and move forward.
So with that, earlier you said work with this group you're talking about, take the pulse of the congregation, try to figure all this stuff out. Mm-hmm. That sounds like that's a process. Mm-hmm. And then how do you line all that up? And then you get your four candidates. I mean, does it all happen at the same time? You have to get one done, and then this comes on, and it just seems hard to thread that needle from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, well, there is a sense of like, oh, we need to get started on this because you don't know how long it's going to take, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, I would want the congregation, like Night Crossing, to go through a process of getting the house in order, of gaining clarity about these things, of being able to invite the church into a process where you're hearing their voices and being able to articulate a clear picture of McKnight Crossings in such a way that you can convey that to a prospective candidate. Mm-hmm. Because you want to put your best foot forward. It's sort of like, since we're all guys in here, it's like courting. It's like wooing a little bit. You want to present yourself well. And so a lot of this work that we're doing to get the house in order is sort of, we're cutting out a new dress.
Yeah.
Getting our hair done. This metaphor.
Yeah.
It's probably not. In fact, it's not a good metaphor.
But we understand exactly.
And so we want to be able to present ourselves, the McKnight Crossing, in such a way that we can engage with prospective candidates well.
And then once we engage, you're saying you may not have a lot of time. You got to be ready to seal the deal.
So some churches will, so you take a month and you, what both IMP does and what we do is we work with a network of, rather than putting an ad in the Christian Chronicle or other places, we typically encourage people to work with what we call recommenders, where people like myself who are well situated around our colleges or nonprofit groups that are broadly aware and say, here's our congregational profile. Here's the story of McKnight Road. And would you help us identify a prospective minister or two based on this? And you've got assets here to do that. Steve knows a lot of people. Jeff knows a lot of people. So we do this kind of network. So we know, there's people at Lipscomb we can utilize. There's people at Harding Grad School, ACU, Christian, Pepperdine. And so we run those trap lines and hope to garner up over, say, a month's time, 4 to 6, eight candidates. But if one or two start to pop up and the committee begins to work with them and they begin to see, this is really looking strong. What I was saying earlier is I don't want to wait 6 weeks
right.
and not move or begin to initiate a relationship and foster a connection to a prospective minister just because we only got one or two candidates. Does that help?
Yeah.
And getting, how do you say this? I've seen that you get a youth minister from Texas, they'll stay for a year or two and want to go back home.
Yeah,
right. And it's the same thing with...
There's a regional, there are things that mitigate that, and this is a part of the challenge of finding someone in a lead minister role, is that more and more ministers, it's not just about them moving, it's moving their family, and it's not just about his career, it's about her career. Mm-hmm. And this is probably one of the biggest things that I've seen. There are some worth good ministers who happen to have a wife who's a tenured professor someplace. And she's not going to walk out of that tenured faculty position and move just anywhere. Mm-hmm. Or I've got a guy who'd love to preach, but his wife is a pediatrician in a small town south of Nashville. Well, she's not going to give up her thriving practice easily to go move to St. Louis. So that's complexifying this because, frankly, they're relying on her income to make it through. So regionality, so there's that factor, and then back to your point.
Yeah.
It needs to be somebody who kind of likes the
Cardinals.
Right? Who can find St. Louis to be an exciting, dynamic city to live in, which it is, in fact. We were at the Hill last night having a great Italian dinner. Love it. I can't even say the name of the place. Favazzi's?
Favazzi's.
And then we went to Joey B's today. So yeah, just
there you go, two for two.
So, but right, I mean, this is part of the story.
Right. And,
But you're going to have to find somebody who actually says going to Cardinal games and eating on the Hill and Forest Park. I love it, right? But whatever those things are, but there'll also be a professional career question probably for the spouse. Can she find her place in this? There was a time when Jeff started and when I started, I don't think we thought about the spouse much. Right? She just kind of did whatever. But more and more for this kind of role, that spouse will be a psychologist.
Good point.
You know, she may have her own career. And so can we... But St. Louis is... I mean, there's a lot of opportunities.
Yes, that's true.
So there's universities, there's hospitals, there's going to be economic possibility and career possibility for a spouse here that it will not be found in Throckmorton, Texas.
Yeah.
Think the odds are we could find a female minister?
Well, they're coming down the pike, and there'll be a day when more and more churches will welcome that. In fact, in the graduate school theology, I don't know what our ratio is, but I expect close to a third of our students are women. They're thinking about chaplaincy, they're thinking about mission work, they're thinking about nonprofit work. And so there's more and more women responding to a call to do something for Jesus. And so I don't know
guys,
if that's, that may be
yeah, helpful. Almost I'm 9 o'clock. Sure. Yeah. Two minutes. We'll wrap it up. Any closing thoughts, remarks, questions, prayers?
I did. I guess I'm really enamored with those three B's. Mm-hmm. And Don kind of alluded to this earlier about how some of the members are feeling this sense of not belonging. Although they've been here for years, just listening to you, I'm wondering if some of the things that I'm going to mention, are they interrelated? Maybe they're not. Is that level of dissatisfaction that we're seeing with some of our members been around for a while, for some reason feel like they don't belong, could it have anything to do with clarity of vision? You know, they don't really see what they belong to because the vision is not really clarified. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and are those things related at all, you know? And since things are such an upheaval, you know, their church doesn't look the same. Mm-hmm. And so they've lost their place in all of that restructuring. And you don't have clarity of vision for them to latch on to. So I'm just wondering, if, you know, in terms of our responsibility to make sure the vision is clarified and communicated well, would that help settle them into some belonging, you know, to feel more connected, you know, and that kind of bring a little bit of a, you know, more continuity to their lives. I'm not sure if those things are related or not. I'm asking the question to see if there's some...
Right. Yeah. I think part of the answer probably comes in the sense of what is it that people are, if they're not feeling like they belong, what is that? Is it... If it's my mom, so I'll just use her as a focal lens. If it's older folks, they're probably feeling a sense of loss because the church doesn't look and feel like it did through much of their life.
Yeah.
I happened in passing to say something about being in a church that used hymn books recently. She was alive, which we used hymn books.
Yeah.
Right? So, well, you know my mom. So, and she's here, but... She'd like to be singing out of the hymn book, right? And so you've got probably a population sort of like my mom who still grieve over the loss of the kind of the way in which church was church for her when she was 30 and 40, right? And so I think being able to see some of that is just grief. Mm-hmm. And part of the way you attend to grief is both being, you acknowledge it, you know, give into it. You acknowledge it, but you also say, here's what we're gaining. Mm-hmm. And that's where that clarifying the vision, we're here for a new generation of believers. Our children matter. Our teenagers matter. Mm-hmm. And I think most of your older folks, if it's your older folks that you're thinking about, they're going to go, well, yeah, that matters.
Yeah.
And so, okay. And so I'll live with the fact that I don't have hymn books. You know, does that make sense? So, so being clear about the vision matters, but being able to identify why is that disconnect happening, I think for some it's a grief of loss. And that's, church has changed radically, right? It's changed differently. And I'll take communion, a little thing. We've got a praise team out there. You have, you have instrumental service?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's different. And, you know, women on this, you know, like, oh my goodness. There's this one thing after another.
Yes, it is.
And
that's bad.
Yes. That's, we don't, none of us like change. Yeah. So I, my guess is a lot of, some of that will be there.
Yeah.
The other part of it is, it, well, it, I'd have to know more about where that disconnect is happening. But that, just from that one single focal lens.
The disconnect is in actually the younger people, I think.
Yeah, it is. I agree with you.
Right.
I agree.
It's not so much the older ones. We can get that one. But,
right.
You know, they walk away without saying goodbye. And, you know, it's like,
yes,
you know, they were involved, and then suddenly, boom, they're gone.
Right.
Yeah.
And, for that group, for that group, I think, and I'm not as clear on this, but I think it has to do with the busyness of their lives. They, they're incredible. They've allowed for various for reasons that are pressed on them and for choices they make.
Mm-hmm.
It's a both and.
Yes, I agree.
They are just exhausted, mm-hmm. and so they only have this much time to give to what they call church, and if that which they call church is not really delivering something they desperately need, which I think is actually a sense of transcendence, of entering into the presence of a holy God. If we're just kind of going through the motions, and church is, ah, razzy-dazzy, that ain't cutting it.
Yeah.
And if that's what church has become, or is, we got better things to do with our time. And so...
Do you think, and I think you're making some very good observations, you think most people... I would say they probably can't consciously articulate that.
Yeah,
that's on a deeper, almost subconscious level that's going on. But what they're most needing, they don't even know. They don't know how to specify it. So even when they leave, they might not know why they're leaving, other than I'm not finding what I need. I can't articulate what it is that I actually need.
Right. They just know they're exhausted.
Maybe why they don't tell us why they're leaving a lot of time.
Right.
Because they really can't articulate why they're leaving. They won't give us an explanation, so we can't figure out how can we maybe not lose as many of those people because we're doing something that we're not, that we can maybe correct. And so we don't hear back from them. And it may be because they don't know how to articulate, they're just that low dissatisfaction.
Right. It's an unspoken, thing. I say that because some of the data, and then what I'm seeing in this one church I'm actively consulting with that has launched a service that happens in the afternoon that is so different. They do have instruments, but it's done in an old chapel with candles. And liturgy, and it feels sort of like you're in an Anglican service, except it's sort of Church of Christ eyes.
Watch out, Brad.
and they've got they've got 30 and 40 year olds coming to that for about a 45 or 50 minute service in the afternoon.
Yeah.
They're not church people. Mm-hmm. They're coming because there's something that happens at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in that space where there's prayers. There's a sermon.
Mm-hmm.
And the songs are reverential. It's instrumental, most of it. But it's not razzy-dazzy and, hey, good
to be, how would it be, happy to be, Carson, a Christian. Just out of curiosity, how would it be different from an Anglican or a Lutheran or Episcopalian service, other than it not being in the morning and being put on by younger people?
Yeah, it still reflects a sense of a more of a democratic, the clergy's not showing up.
Right, there's not the
and
that's right.
The leading voices in that, the the minister who leads it, who happens to be a woman.
Woman, yeah.
They're living life together.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of community
yeah.
there that is deep and relational.
Right.
It's not a formal thing, you go and then walk out. These people hang around and talk for another hour afterwards, which never happens in an Anglican or Episcopal
no.
church.
No, it doesn't happen in Episcopal church.
They're just there for that. So, which is one of the things yeah. about Church of Christ. Being in assembly matters to us,
yes.
typically. To be together and worship together is almost like a sacrament for us. In fact, I think it's the third sacrament for us. There's baptism, there's Lord's Supper, and there's the assembly.
yeah.
But they're hanging there because
by
they
assembly,
have...
you mean community.
Yeah, yeah. the worship time together, yeah, to be together as a community.
Yeah.
So there's some... But that's scratching an itch for people who are not coming to more of a traditional Church mm-hmm. of Christ service.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a lot of data one
yeah.
experience, so I want to be careful here. But it does sort of correlate with this notion that a lot of these 40-somethings, 30, 40-somethings,
mm-hmm.
are just simply so busy they don't have time to play at church. They've got plenty of things to play. They've got their families. They've got careers. They've got their own hobbies. So if they're not getting something that's transcendent, which they can't get without being a part of something bigger than themselves.
40 years ago, our wives would put on a week-long VBS and have 250 kids up here.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a staff for that. You know, it was just because
amazing.
We had wives that,
yeah.
you know, were in the home
gifted.
And
yeah.
could do that sort
yeah.
of stuff. And we've now replaced that with staff that has to do everything. And people
have the kids.
You know, when they come, I drop my dollar in and, you know, I've done my duty. And
yeah.
you know.
But because the wives are all working.
Right.
One of the reasons, yeah.
So you have to bring in youth interns and yeah. find other ways to staff this.
Yeah.
It's a shifting reality of our culture and times. Yeah.
yeah.
Thank you for allowing
Thank
me
you.
To spend time
Thank
with you all.
Yeah.
May the Lord
Thank
bless you,
you
keep yeah. you in the good work that you